and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the full-throated endorsement of net neutrality by President Obama and speak with Craig Aaron, the Managing Director of Free Press, about his article at the Huffington Post, "The President Might Have Just Saved the Internet," and discuss what impact this will have on the FCC, who have been inundated with millions of petitions from American citizens demanding a free and open internet, but have recently shown signs that they will try to compromise with a hybrid proposal allowing paid prioritization and other restrictions favoring cable and telecom monopolies. Then Laura Poitras joins us in the studio to discuss her new film, Citizens 4, which is about NSA surveillance and Edward Snowden, and is now in theatres. She is a documentary filmmaker, journalist and artist who in January of 2013 was contacted by an anonymous source claiming to have evidence of NSA illegal activity. After several months of anonymous emails, she travelled to Hong Kong with Glenn Greenwald to interview the source, who turned out to be Edward Snowden. Her NSA reporting contributed to a Pulitzer Prize for Public Service awarded to The Guardian and The Washington Post. And along with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, she is co-founder of The Intercept. Joining us now is Craig Aaron, who is the Managing Director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The President Might Have Just Saved the Internet." Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Well, thanks for having me back on.
And in terms of the president making this extraordinarily and unequivocal endorsement for net neutrality and urging the FCC to adopt strict rules to protect and preserve it, that is extremely welcome. It seems a little odd. It came after the elections. But nevertheless, I take it you're a happy camper today, Craig.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very pleased with what the president said today because his statement was such a clear and, as you say, unequivocal statement of support for real net neutrality. He was very specific in how the FCC should proceed, and it really endorsed the policy positions that Free Press and hundreds of other organizations and millions of people have been fighting for around this issue of net neutrality. You know, today the president, got out of the backseat and into the driver's seat on this issue, and he very much is siding with the public interest in those positions, which is a significant shift that I trust will not be lost on the decision makers at the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, it's hard to understand how it could be lost on them, because when you talk about the public interest, in terms of public comments, the FCC has never received so many comments. It broke down their system. Millions of Americans wrote into them and demanded net neutrality, and I believe it was like 90% of all the mail they got was urging them. And even in the last couple of days, there have been demonstrators at Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC's home in Washington, D.C. So there's no way in the world that Tom Wheeler and the FCC don't know, surely, that there is a tremendous public interest in this.
Well, I think that's right, and the record numbers are correct, 99% of the public comments, but so often Washington, D.C. can be such a bubble, and especially for a guy like FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, who comes out of industry, who is used to these sort of insider and elite conversations, and unfortunately has dodged or tried to dodge a lot of the public conversations. So I think there's absolutely, President Obama's statement today is a result of public pressure. Without all that public pressure, the president does not make this statement. All of those comments and petitions, the hundreds and thousands of phone calls that have been going into the White House, the protests outside the White House, that got the FCC's attention. And I think it directly got the president's attention, who is on the record for net neutrality and finally instructed his administration to take a strong and clear stand. And really to tell the FCC to stop messing around, stop trying to come up with some convoluted, complex way around doing what you need to do, which is just make clear rules that will stand up in court. That's the message the president sent today, and it is very, very helpful in this net neutrality fight. It's great political cover for the chairman and the other two commissioners, and it's also just a very clear policy statement. You don't have to read between the lines. You don't have to guess what he's saying. He actually lays out very clear policies, and I believe those policies are absolutely in line with the real net neutrality, you know, we've been fighting for close to a decade.
And do you think the president went public with this strong endorsement for net neutrality because of that Wall Street Journal article that suggested that the FCC were coming up with some compromise, some hybrid compromise?
Yeah, I think my understanding is that, you know, the White House has been going through a very long policy process throughout this whole debate, trying to decide if and when to weigh in. These very confusing hybrid proposals were floated that would have really fundamentally changed how the internet worked. Yet again, the public response to those proposals was scorn and confusion and disappointment because the FCC wasn't doing what the public was asking. And I think that's what prompted the White House to finally weigh in and say to the FCC, you know, really stop trying to come up with another way to do this when there's an obvious way to do it right. And so I think the failed trial balloon that the FCC launched, combined with the election results and combined with really the ticking clock, because there were a lot of indications coming out of the FCC that they wanted to move toward a vote on December 11th, that this was finally the time that the administration chose to weigh in. You know, and while many of us had asked them to weigh in earlier or could have hoped they'd done it sooner, the fact that they did do it now when it really matters and did it in such a clear way, you can read it for yourself over at whitehouse.gov, I think really matters. It completely upends this debate and for a change does it in a way that is actually in the public interest.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the managing director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The President Might Have Just Saved the Internet." Now, the FCC has been trying to, thread the needle here in an impossible way for the longest time because a decision made by Michael Powell back during the Bush administration basically set the stage for all of this confusion and all this threat to an open and free internet, and that was by not classifying it, I guess, as a utility. And even the Verizon suit, which Verizon won with the second most powerful court in the land, they said in their ruling that the FCC still has the ability to reclassify. And is that what the president's saying here, that they finally
got what the president has endorsed is what's called Title II broadband reclassification. And essentially, the term, the legal term of art here is common carrier, which is what the phone system has always been. There are many other things in the transportation realm in particular that are common carriers, places that have an obligation not to discriminate, to serve all comers equally. Basically, the FCC has tried to avoid fixing the basic problem here, which is that they abdicated their own authority over broadband, and they've come up with all kinds of complicated ways to do it. Those have been thrown out by the courts not once but twice. In reaction to the last time they lost, the court was very clear. They said, if you want to stop website blocking, if you want to stop unreasonable discrimination, then you need to change the classification. You have to call these common carriers. And the FCC has been reluctant to do so for reasons that mostly, I think, have to do with sort of a misguided sense of the politics, that they don't want to have a big fight with the powerful internet service providers. They're probably going to get that fight anyway, and those of us who've been advocating for net neutrality, you know, just had to say this new hybrid proposal based on law that's never existed before, that's sort of being made up as we go, that is not going to be the surest protection for internet users. That's not going to stand up in court. No one's thought through the ramifications. There's a clear path, Title II reclassification, grounded in literally decades of law, in line with the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and that's what the FCC needs to do. And today, Barack Obama agreed with us and said, that's clearly the best way to do it. Get to it, FCC, which they hadn't said before. They sort of allowed them to explore these other options, but clearly those other options just wouldn't cut it, and they were all received very negatively by the public, by internet companies, even by the ISPs in most cases, who are very skeptical of these hybrid proposals. So I think the good news is the Obama administration looked at all these options and finally came down, frankly, where they should have started, which is that broadband reclassification is the best option.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Greg Aaron, it would seem to me that what's really at stake here is that the country that invented the internet is slipping behind the rest of the world, both in speed and you get less for more. In other words, you pay more money for less service, less speed. Only Chattanooga, which is a public utility, gives you 1,000 megabytes a gigabyte. The average in America is 9.6 megabytes per second, which is appalling compared to South Korea, Japan, France, where you get 1,000 in megabytes in South Korea for $30 a month. I mean, it's an absolute disgrace that these government-protected monopolies are fleecing the American people and causing this country to slip behind and by the abuse of one of the greatest tools accessible to mankind, which could have enormous economic implications if it's used correctly.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with your analysis, Ian, and you know, I think this net neutrality fight is so important because it's the first step back. Net neutrality doesn't solve all those problems, but a political victory on net neutrality, clear rules of the road, are what set in motion a completely different kind of debate over how do we create real competition? How do we create incentives for communities and remove obstacles to communities actually investing in broadband networks? How do we learn from the rest of the world who frankly just borrow the policies we used to have when it comes to open access and begin to catch up with the Japans and South Koreas and even Europe who are getting ahead of us? And I think this net neutrality fight has become such a flashpoint because if we can win this one, it really sets in motion a much better political environment. And it's the beginning between net neutrality, between the SOPA-PIPA fight, and maybe a few other examples that begins to make the internet itself something of a third rail issue in politics. And that's what we have to build towards, so that our internet policies aren't designed simply to benefit the Comcasts, Verizons, and AT&Ts of the world, but actually the hundreds of millions of internet users all across this country, essentially everybody in this country. The president's statement today, really strong step in the right direction, but now it's time to redouble and ramp up the pressure to make sure we get these rules and make sure if Congress does consider reopening the fundamental communications laws of this country, that it's with an eye toward competition, choice, local investment, and not just what's in the best interest of a giant telecom company.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Craig Aaron.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the Managing Director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The President Might Have Just Saved the Internet." We're going to take a brief station break and be back joined in the studio by Laura Poitras, the documentary filmmaker, journalist, and artist who was first contacted by Edward Snowden, and she has made an extraordinary film about him, Citizen 4. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in studio is Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and artist who has made a trilogy of films about post-9/11 America. Her first film, My Country, My Country, focused on the Iraq War and was nominated for an Academy Award in 2007. The second, The Oath, about Guantanamo, was nominated for two Emmy Awards. The third of the 9/11 trilogy, Citizen 4, now out in theaters, is about NSA mass surveillance and Edward Snowden. In January 2013, Poitras was contacted by an anonymous source claiming to have evidence of NSA illegal activity. After several months of anonymous emails, she traveled to Hong Kong with Glenn Greenwald to interview the source, Edward Snowden. Her NSA reporting contributed to a Pulitzer Prize for Public Service awarded to The Guardian and The Washington Post. Along with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, she is the co-founder of The Intercept. And Laura will have her first solo museum exhibition at the Whitney Museum in 2016, and she currently lives in Berlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Poitras.
Hey, it's great to see you again.
And Laura, just to touch on Berlin, I guess you must have been traveling for the 25th anniversary, but it was interesting that Gorbachev warned about a new Cold War amidst the celebrations. There's a dark cloud looming.
Well, I hope he's wrong. But it was interesting. We actually just premiered Citizen 4 in Germany, and we premiered it in what was the former East Berlin. And it was, it's fitting somehow that the reporting on the NSA surveillance is happening, has unfolded for me in what was, you know, the place where the Stasi was known for its surveillance of citizens.
Where Angela Merkel comes from.
Exactly, where Angela Merkel comes from. So it's quite fitting, and it also makes a lot of sense of why in Germany the response to the disclosures has been so, you know, vocal, because they have this history of what it is like to live in a society where, you know, your government is surveilling people.
So contrast that then to the U.S. Where do we stand? Because I've seen your film, and I found it extraordinarily powerful and a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And I found Edward Snowden, particularly when you introduce him for the first time, to be extremely articulate and obviously deeply intelligent. And a powerful message, which was that he wants to try to alter the relationship between the state and the individual, that the state now has more power over the individual, and the state is supposed to be the servant of the individual, but that is clearly not what's happening, and that his efforts were to reverse that. So where do you think we stand, particularly in contrast, say, to Germany?
So I think, I mean, what you describe is correct. I mean, what Snowden was seeing is that there were things that were being kept secret from the public that he felt that the public should know about. So, for instance, the first story that Glenn Greenwald published in The Guardian was about the Verizon order, the FISA order, which revealed that the government had created a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act that allowed them to collect all call records of all U.S. citizens, which, is now being challenged in court because I think on its face it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the idea that the government was engaging in these kinds of policies and doing it in secret, I think, is what motivated Snowden to come forward. In terms of the U.S. and its sort of relationship to surveillance, we certainly have dark periods in this country where people were targeted for, you know, surveillance by the government, and particularly in the 60s and 70s, we see the targeting of civil rights activists and what happened in infiltrating the FBI, infiltrating communities to find out what was going on and really targeting people and entrapment, all that kind of stuff. It's not that we don't see that today. I mean, we've seen that certainly in the Muslim American community in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. They became the community that came under suspicion. And I think that if you speak to Muslim Americans in this country, they will tell you the sort of pernicious impact of surveillance on communities where you don't know who's listening, and there's, you know, a chilling effect and restraining of, you know, basic principles that, you know, the country's founded on, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of movement, all those kinds of things are being encroached upon because of what the government and the NSA are doing.
But, you know, it was almost like one man, J. Edgar Hoover, who was a peculiar fellow with obviously an overactive paranoia and a deep-seated anti-communism. But the NSA, of course, is not one man. It's a vast machine, isn't it?
Right. I mean, what we're seeing with the NSA, is also very much a byproduct of the Internet. So you have the emergence of the Internet, which allowed for, you know, communication across the globe at unprecedented ability for people to just to connect. And then you have, you know, intelligence agencies who are coming in and using the Internet or turning the Internet into something else, which is a system to monitor people and something that they believe should be militarized. I mean, we have the creation of Cyber Command, which is a military command that, you know, exists in cyberspace, and that's completely new. So what's possible now with signals intelligence was not possible under, you know, the FBI and Hoover, and in terms of the vast amount of information that could be collected about people and what can be done with that information.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and artist who's made a trilogy of films about post-9/11, the latest of which is Citizen 4, now out in theaters, which is about NSA mass surveillance and Edward Snowden. So, Laura, take us back to why you got this contact out of the blue. He chose to talk to you, to make you the primary source of this extraordinarily explosive information, which is probably one of the greatest exposés in terms of information, at least in recent history. So give us a sense of why he chose you and how that was done.
So I received the first email from someone in January 2013 asking me for my public key, which would allow us to speak with encryption over email. And I had already had set up encryption, so I immediately responded and said, you know, here you go. What's up? Who are you? Why are you contacting me? And then he responded by saying that he was, you know, worked in the intelligence community and that he had information, that it wouldn't be a waste of my time. And he asked me to set up more secure means of talking to him. And in terms of why he picked me, I mean, I, of course, asked that question immediately because I wasn't a likely person to reach out to. I mean, I'm a visual journalist. I don't work for a newspaper. And so I asked him, you know, why are you contacting me? And his response was that I had picked myself. And what he was referring to was the fact that I'd been placed on a government watch list. And
that was because of the Iraq film, right?
Yeah, so after finishing a film about the Iraq War in 2006, I started being stopped and questioned every time I crossed the U.S. border, every time I returned home. And I would, you know, be held and had notebooks photocopied and, you know, receipts photocopied and electronics seized. And that went on for a number of years. And I had gone public about it in a number of ways. Glenn Greenwald had written a story about my border detentions in the spring of 2012, and I believe that Snowden read that. And then after that, I made a short film that was published on the for the New York Times about William Binney, an older generation of NSA whistleblower, and where I also published a short essay about being on a watch list. And I think that Snowden had read both of those things, and that was what motivated him to contact me. And you know, the other thing in terms of putting into context is that he had already tried to reach out to Glenn Greenwald in December, a month before he reached out to me, and Glenn didn't have encryption set up, and so then he reached out to me, and I did, and then we were able to set up a conversation pretty quickly, and he early on said that he urged me to also partner with Glenn, and I think that his feeling was that both Glenn and I had been doing reporting on the post-9/11 era that was critical of what the government was doing, that we weren't doing, we were questioning, and we were not using euphemisms like enhanced interrogation techniques to describe what was torture and what we all know now is torture. And so I think things like that, that he perceived us as being a bit outsider and a bit more adversarial to the government. I think so all those factors, I think, led to the fact that I got a mysterious email in my inbox. And because I had been stopped at the U.S. border so many times, I became adept at using encryption and how to protect my source material. So it wasn't hard for me to use those tools, and so I was ready for that. And so then we began a long correspondence that went on for 5 months until we went to Hong Kong.
And he was presumably in Hawaii, and you were in Berlin.
Right. Yeah. The first email I received, I was in Berlin. I didn't know where he was.
And you didn't know anything about him until you met him, right?
Yeah. Nothing. I mean, I knew nothing. And he also, I think, led me to believe that he was older than he was. And he would talk about, like, I remember back in the day, and he would refer to things. And I think he was just trying to keep me guessing of, you know, where he worked.
Right. So then take us to the point where you get to Hong Kong and you actually meet him.
So I'd contacted Glenn while I was in correspondence to let him know that I'd been contacted by a source and asked him if he'd want to be involved in the reporting, and he immediately said yes. And it took a while for sort of everything to come into place where we actually got on a plane because, again, Glenn didn't have encryption, so it was hard for me to communicate, you know, what was happening. But I had managed to convince the source I was talking to, who we now know to be Snowden, to meet in person. And his first response was that he thought that was risky and he didn't want to do it. And at the beginning, he always had intended to come forward as the source. Like, he wasn't going to hide that information. And when he told me that in April is when I said, well, then I want to meet you and I want to film and I want to understand what your motivations are. And his response was, no, I'm not the story. I don't want to do that. And if we meet, it's risky because if we get shut down, will it stop the reporting? And I responded by saying that he was going to be the story. You know, the media was going to talk about him and that only he could articulate what his motivations were. And so I really pushed to have a face-to-face. And then, you know, fast forward at the end of May, Glenn joined me in New York, and then we found out where we were going, which was Hong Kong. And we arrived, and it was also with another journalist from The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill. In the first meeting, it was me and Glenn in a public place, and Snowden walked by and, has been widely reported, was carrying a Rubik's Cube, which was how we were to identify him. And our first reaction was we were surprised at how young he was. I mean, we had imagined we were meeting somebody older in the intelligence community.
So, but you're looking at somebody but not acknowledging them.
Right. He walked by, we stood up, and he said, follow me. And then we went to his hotel room. And then once we got into the hotel room, I took out my camera and started filming pretty quickly. I knew Glenn pretty well at that point, and I know he doesn't waste a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And I knew he'd be, you know, asking questions right away, so I didn't want to be sort of...
Flat-footed.
I didn't want to be flat-footed or polite and say, you know, everyone knew that I was going to bring my camera. It wasn't a secret to anyone. And I just thought that this was an extraordinary moment where a source was willing to go on the record like this and take the risks, and that I felt as a documentarian, I wanted to record mm-hmm. that, and I wanted to record the sort of initial encounter of mm-hmm. what was happening. And then, you know, when I was in Hong Kong, I really felt that my job was there as a documentary filmmaker, recording this encounter, journalism happening. I wasn't at that point working with Glenn on the stories. He was doing the print stories, but I was trying to understand, like it was sort of a window into journalism you never see, right? Because in most cases, the risk for the source are so high that they want to remain anonymous. And so the fact that I could film that, so I was really there in Hong Kong focusing on documenting what was happening. And then when I returned to Berlin, I shifted and started working on the archive and doing print reporting along with Der Spiegel magazine and then mm-hmm. other outlets.
So when you say that Edward Snowden didn't want to become the story, mm-hmm. that's exactly what happens to whistleblowers. The way they go after whistleblowers is to go after the messenger and not so that they muddy the waters with the message.
Right.
And that's clearly, he's obviously a bright guy. He must have known that was going to happen. So why then did he choose Hong Kong, which is China, and then later, of course, Russia? So, which, of course, a lot of people mm-hmm. are very suspicious about because they are both countries hostile to free speech and to an open and free internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he chose to go to Hong Kong, where there is more of a tradition of free speech than there is in mainland China. But in terms of my conversations with him, I had no idea why he chose actually to go mm-hmm. to Hong Kong. I actually didn't know where we were meeting until the very, very last minute. And then once I found out, then it became clear to me that he was going to be seeking political asylum, which I didn't know until he revealed where he was. And I think that he wanted to basically go to a place where he felt that he could speak to journalists and pass along this information. And I think he felt that, based on the research he had done, that Hong Kong is a place where that he could do that. And in terms of what happened after that, and as has been widely reported, he was actually trying to seek political asylum or leave Hong Kong after the U.S. issued extradition request for him, and was traveling and was transiting through Russia, and his passport was revoked, which is why he remained stranded.
Yeah. So transiting to where, though?
Latin America. I believe he was that he could have entered into Ecuador. Other countries, Venezuela has also been talked about. I mean, I wasn't, as a journalist, I was really working with him as a journalist
with him, right.
Yeah, and that I was working on the stories. I wasn't talking to him that much about what his plans were for seeking political asylum, so I don't know all the details, but I do know that he didn't intend to end up in Russia, but he was trying to transit through and his passport was revoked.
Right. And the extent to which who decided what stories to... I mean, well, actually, I think the key question, which other people have asked a lot, particularly his critics, is the idea that he had with him valuable, incredibly valuable secrets, and therefore was risking exposure to foreign powers, particularly hostile powers like China and Russia. My understanding is, and in your film you make it clear, that the material that he has with him, he's saying that nobody can get it. It's not, it's sort of not physical in a way. And it's not entirely clear to me how that, because I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to the, I can barely get email done. So tell me, explain to me how he engineered this in such a way that nobody could actually, you know, torture this information out of him in a dark cell, that this is something. He set up a system whereby the information can only be accessed by, I take it, by you and Glenn Greenwald and whoever had the passwords.
So, you know, I think the thing that's important to remember is that that he was trained both by the CIA and the NSA and was working for them and was very sophisticated in his ability to understand how encryption works and how to sort of defeat against an adversary. And I can say for certain what motivated him was a feeling that that the U.S. public had a right to know what was happening in terms of intelligence, and he had no intention of ever releasing that to any other government, and he created a system to make that impossible, as he says in the film, that he can't, you know, so it's not something he can memorize. So the systems, I mean, he's smart enough not to tell me the details of how he created those systems, but
and that's why he puts the bag over his head in the film.
I mean, he covers his, you know, his computer because he wants to avert any risk of visual surveillance. So his ability to encrypt and to set up a system, I have complete faith in. And he's not going to tell me what that is, because his whole point is to say that it can't be, it's not something that anyone could obtain. And then what happened is that the information that he shared with Glennon and myself and Ewan McCaskill and Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, I mean, what he did is he said he put it in our hands to decide what was information that, you know, that was in the public interest, and that we've been reporting on that. And so all the stories have gone through a journalistic process of making those determinations, not just the individual journalists, but individual journalists working with editorial teams that are, you know, making the decisions of what to publish and what not to publish.
But just to get a picture for the audience and for me, the internet Luddite, it's somewhere, right? It's, even though it's sort of almost in the ether, all of this stuff exists somewhere, but it still can only be accessed by a few people, like you and Barton Gellman, Ewan McCaskill, and Glenn Greenwald. Is that where it stands?
Right. I mean, I'm not going to go into details about, you know, I mean, obviously, there are lots of reasons why I'm not going to go into details about, who has access to documents and how they're stored. But I can say it's not like, I mean, we're all using extreme caution in terms of how to, you know, who has access and how to, you know, report on this. And Snowden, you know, doesn't at this point have access to the information.
Right. And nobody else does, in the sense that it's secure.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, it's, I mean, when he traveled.
Because there's a lot more to come, isn't there? I mean, we're talking. What percentage do you think has been released?
There's definitely more reporting that we're doing.
Right.
And it's not something you can calculate in terms of percentages, because some of the stories are based on, you know, dozens of documents. Some of them are, you know, a story based on one document, like the Verizon order, the first story that Glenn did. So it's a sort of a range of terms of how the reporting is happening.
But at the time, and it's actually, as we're speaking now, Obama's meeting with President Xi. And the last time he met with President Xi was out here in Palm Springs. And on the eve of that meeting, there was a release from Snowden of a presidential finding that the U.S. was targeting China for cyber warfare. And that was apparently going to be on the agenda at this meeting. So who made those kind of decisions to put that out at that critical moment?
I mean, so the way that the reporting is done has happened at different, you know, there's not like a big, you know, a calendar where we're saying we're going to release this, and this. I mean, it's happened within different news organizations. So I've been working most closely in Germany with Der Spiegel, but also with other papers. Glenn was first with The Guardian, is now reporting with The Intercept, and Barton Gellman has been working.
And The Intercept is a new news organization that you, Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald founded.
Exactly. Right. And so a lot of the reporting happened because of, you know, the different interests of different journalists. And so, for instance, I reported on with Der Spiegel on the spying of Angela Merkel, and that was published the same week that Glenn reported on France, and we didn't coordinate those. I mean, it was the story that happened in that was published about France was in the works for a really long time, and then the Merkel story broke early because the German government had contacted Obama to ask about the spying. So, but then people write the story about it being a coordinated thing, and it's actually was much more organic than that. I mean, mm-hmm. the way things actually unfolded. So I think that it's, you know, individual, you know, journalists are following things that they're particularly interested in and the papers, and there's not I am in touch with, I was in touch with Glenn when Glenn was reporting with The Guardian. I was with Der Spiegel, so we sort of knew what stories we had in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. But there's not coordinated, we are publishing this in response to any particular world events.
I see. And the story that you're talking about that Der Spiegel published and that the Germans called Obama over, of course, was the tapping of Angela Merkel's cell phone and knowing what sandwiches she was ordering for lunch, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that has really apparently upset her considerably.
Yeah, I think she wasn't too happy about that.
Right. And by extension, the German people. And you mentioned earlier that with the history of the Stasi, there's a particular kind of irony here.
Yeah. I mean, I think I want to loop back to a previous question you asked about the China situation. I mean, one of the things that we've exposed is the hypocrisy in some of the U.S. policy, that there's been a lot of stories about China hacking into, you know, U.S. companies. But, you know, what we're also seeing is the extent to which the U.S. is doing the same thing. And you know, that's the kind of political landscape that, mm-hmm. that we're seeing, that it's not just, you know, China that's engaging in this kind of cyber attacks.
No, well, in fact, James Bamford met with Edward Snowden in Moscow, and one of the things he reported in Wired was that the U.S. has actually set up a kind of doomsday machine. That the minute that any hacking comes from China, there's an immediate retaliation. And with the nature of the internet being that there are so many cutouts and there's so many people that, you know, false flags, as they say in the intelligence world, you never know who's. So we could attack China when, in fact, it's come from Moldova or somewhere.
That's
you
right.
know. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back continuing the conversation with Laura Poitras. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm continuing the conversation now in studio with Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and artist who made a trilogy of films about post-9/11 America, the latest of which is Citizen 4, now out in theaters. It's about NSA, mass surveillance, and Edward Snowden. So in the film, then, we're at the point where you mentioned Edward Snowden's real intentions was to go on via Moscow onto somewhere else in Latin America. And because the U.S. pulled his passport, he got stranded in Russia. In the film, there's an abrupt cut to WikiLeaks. So give us the smooth over that transition, because how did that happen? How did they get into the mix?
So Glenn and I did the initial reporting, and then we published the video where Snowden comes forward and claims he says his involvement as the source for these disclosures and why and his motivation, and then he goes underground. So that's what you see in the film. He leaves the hotel, and I stop following him at that point. And I returned to Berlin. Glenn returns to Rio, and what had happened is that WikiLeaks, particularly one of their editors, Sarah Harrison, met with him in Hong Kong and assisted him to seek political asylum. And was
she contacted, or did Did they contact him or did he contact them?
I actually don't know the details. I wasn't involved in that. And so I don't know how, but she went there and she met him in Hong Kong and traveled with him. And they had a flight that was, I think, going it was Moscow via Cuba and then to Latin America. And that's the route that they were on. And they were held up in Russia, and so the scene that you see in the film is footage of Julian Assange talking about seeing if there was a way to get a private jet to get him out of Moscow to a country that would provide political asylum.
And that was Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's essentially been holed up for almost, 2 years now?
Right. So Julian Assange has political asylum from Ecuador, and he's been in the embassy in London for over 2 years. And so he's on the telephone talking to people about options for getting a flight for Snowden. And that's footage.
Did you film that?
I didn't, actually. This is footage that Julian and WikiLeaks filmed internally that we knew about and that we licensed for the film because we were interested in showing how it was that Snowden was able to leave Hong Kong, and what we also know is that Sarah Harrison stayed with him while he was in the airport. So she was, to be a witness to basically to counter these claims that were expected that the government would say that he met with intelligence agencies both either in China or Hong Kong to so there was somebody there who could say categorically that never happened, and also Sarah navigated his applications for political asylum. So he applied for political asylum to over 24 countries. And I think that her expertise in the case of Julian Assange, because he also went through a process of seeking political asylum, so she had a lot of experience in doing that.
Right. Well, I'm sure you know that the chairman of the House Select Intelligence Committee, I don't know whether it's at the time, but around that time, made the charge that Sarah Harrison was with the FSB, and that the whole, he made the implication that this whole thing was a Russian operation. This is this fellow, Mike Rogers.
Right. I've never heard that quote. I mean, I know it's completely false. It's absolutely false. And people within the government have also said that that's false. They don't believe that to be true.
So this whole era where that whole time that the whole world was watching the airport and this kind of transit zone, did you get cameras there? What's your understanding about what happened? Because that was a period where everybody in the world was focused on, and I remember there was that incident where the president's plane was.
Right. Yes. They suspected he might have been on the plane, and they forced his plane to land.
Yeah, it's like, where's Waldo on steroids,
I mean, I can definitely say, I was in Berlin during this time. It was definitely, these were tense days. The U.S. government was clearly not happy, and nor was the U.K. government, and they were trying to figure out what they could do and how they could stop publication. Lots of things happened during those weeks. I did try to get to Moscow so I could film inside the airport. It didn't work out, unfortunately. Obviously, if it did, it would be in the film. But I know that there's actually another filmmaker who's working on a film that's going to look at those days in the Moscow airport.
Mm. Well, you did manage to get I thought, a very, very powerful shot. It just of a window at night with Snowden and his girlfriend, fiance, just being very domestic, making pasta or something, is somewhere in Moscow. And that was surprising. I didn't know that she had joined him, because there's a whole sequence in your film where he's extremely concerned about his girlfriend. He couldn't tell his girlfriend what he was doing because that knowledge would implicate her, and she'd be therefore liable under criminal statute. So she was something of a sacrificial lamb in this whole thing. But on the other hand, what I found interesting about the fact that you end up in the film with her and him in this sort of domestic bliss in somewhere in Moscow is that there was obviously they overcame whatever the misunderstandings or the tensions were. So to walk us through that.
Sure. I mean, as you say, in Hong Kong, after Glenn published the first story about Verizon order, the NSA showed up at his home in Hawaii and where his girlfriend, Lindsay Mills, was living, looking for him. And I think that's how she learned what was happening. And when you see the impact that has on him, like that he really feels that, I mean, you feel in the film that at that moment, the sacrifice, the personal, you know, sacrifice that he's making and the concern he has for her. And so I'd filmed that, and I'd never tried to reach out to Lindsay Mills. I was really disturbed by how the media went after her, you know, in the immediate aftermath of after we revealed Snowden's identity. It was a typical media frenzy. And I was very disturbed by that, and I thought, well, at some point, hopefully I'll meet her when she's ready. And then I'd heard that she had decided to join him in Moscow, and I thought that was really extraordinary, because I think if anyone had a reason to really, you know, feel just maybe it would be hard to forgive, right? Mm-hmm. What happened, and I thought that it was extraordinary, and I asked if I could film and include that in the at the end of the film, and they agreed, and so I went there. And she's an extraordinary woman. I mean, she's really, and she's been through something, you know, really really difficult, and hopefully she'll tell more of her story at some mm-hmm. point.
But she stood by her man.
I think that she, I mean, I think in the end she understood why he made the choices he made.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I thought was quite shocking in a way was the man that you first meet, when I mentioned this extremely bright, extremely articulate guy, where he's when you first meet him and you first introduce him in the film, as he goes through this experience, explains what he's doing also, he's dealing with the consequences of going public as it impacts his girlfriend in real time. But then later, just about the time that you see him towards the end in Moscow, there is a sequence where he's in Moscow, and the contrast is shocking. He's got these deep, dark circles around his eyes. So what explains that from the earlier guy that you saw that seemed pretty healthy, and even though it's obviously very tense, and you know?
I think what you see in that footage, both of him and of Glenn, is the, you know, even though it's only a year later, the sort of the toll it's taken on both of them, and this sort of transition of, I mean, I think you see a person who goes from, you know, making a decision where there's no turning back, mm-hmm. and then you see actually the consequences of it.
Right. So in terms of in the film, there's a moment where I think he was working with you in Berlin, Glenn Greenwald's partner, and he's intercepted at the London airport, and then he's held by British intelligence. And I believe, I don't know whether that's coincidental, when they went to the basement of the Guardian and destroyed the hard drive. So walk us through what they actually had there, and did you wouldn't have filmed that, right? The basement stuff?
No, it was filmed by the Guardian filmed that.
The mm-hmm. Guardian filmed that. And so what exactly happened there? Mm-hmm. Did anything get compromised in terms of the system that you'd explained that mm-hmm. set up, that he set up? I mean, did Glenn Greenwald's partner have something that they wanted?
Mm-hmm. So what happened was, so as you see in Hong Kong, there's information that's not just relating to the NSA, but the GCHQ, the UK intelligence. And Ewan McCaskill and The Guardian begin reporting on that. And you see that in the film, I film The Guardian offices in London, where they report on a program called Tempora, which is this internet buffer.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah, ubiquitous.
Because people don't recognize it, that the UK, first of all, they have D notices where you can get prior restraint. You can't publish anything relating to intelligence unless they approve it. And they can intercept you. So they're more of a surveillance state, and plus they have tremendous amount of, you know, close-circuit television everywhere. Right. So that was tantalizing, Tempora, because you got the impression that... Did it ever get out, by the way?
I mean, we published on that story, and as you say, that the government issued D notices on all the media organizations, so you have a situation where the other press didn't pick up on it, which was a bit shocking to me, you mm-hmm. know, coming from the U.S., where, you know, it's sort of unimaginable that the press would not publish on something that was a big story, and then you had the pressure that happened on The Guardian, which ultimately resulted in them being asked or forced, depending on how you frame it, to destroy this material in the drive. And then David was detained a couple weeks later at Heathrow. And, you know, for me, the what I've seen is that what was shocking to me is both the press response to the reporting, or the lack of it, or the following of the D notice, and what we and the lack of protection for a free press in the country. In other words, that the reporting on what the government is doing can lead to injunction, prior restraint, as we've seen. So what the Guardian had done is they moved the information that they had to New York so that they could continue reporting on it in partnership with the New York Times. Mm-hmm. But in terms of and what happened with David, he was held under a very pernicious law, the Terrorism Act, and was detained in London for 9 hours. Mm-hmm. And in terms of anything that happened, I mean, those are actually questions that would go to the Guardian, because they were the ones who were coordinating his his travel.
So, just to get a sort of a big perspective on this, because again, the technique with whistleblowers is to go after the messenger and so that the message gets lost. And your film, reminds us of the message. This is why this guy did what he did, and this is what he was hoping to do. And that's why I think it's important for people to see the film. But in terms of where we stand, in terms of the surveillance state, in terms of reform, what do you think? I mean, it feels to me like the government's won.
I'd actually disagree with that. I mean, so what I spend a lot of time with people who work on privacy-related things and circumvention of surveillance, and there are two things that need to be looked at. There's the technology that allows for privacy and communication, and that involves things like encryption, and then you have the government's policy. And so on the technology front, I think we're winning. There are tools that can be used that allow us to encrypt our communication. They exist now. They're free. They work. And it keeps the government from knowing what is in our communication. And now we're also seeing the big tech companies coming forward with ways in which people can have more privacy with their communication. And for them, I think it's a question of the bottom line.
Sure. They know it's cost, I believe, American business hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of the fact that overseas customers don't trust them unless they can assure them that there's no back door to the NSA. So,
well, I think that there's a good reason for overseas customers not to trust. I mean, now that we know what the NSA is doing. So we have Facebook, which is now providing its service on what's called a Tor hidden service, so that you can access Facebook without revealing your location. You have Google and Apple now coming forward with products that will, phones that will use encryption. I think we're going to see more of that. We also have free software tools, things like the Tor browser, which is a way to surf the internet without attaching your search terms to your identity. Mm-hmm. And it's free. It can be downloaded by anyone. You just go to the torproject.org. And so if you're a journalist, for instance, and you want to do research and you don't want all of your research to be associated with your unique IP address and your identity, you're doing anything sensitive, then you can use Tor right now, and it will allow you to search the internet without pointing to your identity, which is really important now, because we have the government doing things like subpoenaing the phone records of AP, or threatening to jail James Risen, who's a personal friend of mine, or James Rosen, who was described as a co-conspirator by the Department of Justice. So if you're a journalist, lawyer, anyone who needs to protect communication, you can do that now. You don't need to wait for governments to change their policy. Where I think you're right in terms of the government not moving is in terms of making actual changes. And so I think these programs are still in place. So we still have the secret interpretation of Section 215, which the government is using to collect all of our U.S. phone records. That's still in place. It's being challenged in court, and might be found to be unconstitutional. I mean, there have been judges who've called it Orwellian and likely unconstitutional. But those legal things are sort of still moving in in the system. So I think, so you have technology where there exist already ways to maintain privacy. You have now in the legal system challenges to these policies now that there's documents on the table that can, that could potentially reverse some of the, what the government is doing. And then you have, government that's, wants to maintain the programs and doesn't want to inform the public of what they're doing.
Well, you mentioned James Rise and also before him, William Arkin. They pointed out the scary part about what's happened since in this post 9/11 era, and that is the contracting of intelligence, this privatization of intelligence, because it's so amorphous, because you don't know what the product is. At least in, with the military industrial complex, they have to produce an airplane or a bomb or a missile. And it's physical. For intelligence contractors, and after all, Edward Snowden was one, working for Booz Allen Hamilton, which in turn is owned by the Carlyle Group, the ultimate in insider trading, if you will, their product is amorphous. We don't know what it is. And yet billions are pouring in. And this is what a lot of people are concerned about, is that this system is metastasized into a major racket that's impenetrable, and they've got so much political power.
Right. And so much information about, U.S. citizens. I mean, these are contractors who have access to...
And therefore, they have information about foreign competitors, too.
Exactly.
So that seems to be, to me, where the problem is, that, when I say that the government's won, how do you undo that?
I mean, so again, let's take it back to Germany. I'm living in what was a former East Germany, and the wall comes down. I mean, there are, you can't give up hope that that the political context that we find ourselves can change. And so, which isn't to say I don't think it's a dire situation. What's happening with the contracting out of intelligence and military? I mean, I spent 8 months in Baghdad and saw all the private contractors / mercenaries being hired to do this war.
They're just now being rehired.
Yeah. I mean, it's disturbing because who are they accountable to? I mean, they're accountable to, profits and not to, the government or citizens. They're not elected. They're oftentimes not, there's no accountability. I mean, that was ultimately what caused the end of the Iraq war, because the Iraqi government said, well, we'd like to hold people accountable in our country if they break our laws, and the U.S. government was opposed to that. And so I do think it's deeply disturbing that we've contracted out all these essential, or not even essential, but these
traditionally government
responsibilities. And they're being tied to profit motives. I mean, Dana Priest has done extraordinary reporting on the topic.
Well, just in closing, what do you think will be Edward Snowden's fate? I mean, he seems to be stranded in Russia. He's almost in no man's land.
So I'm not on his legal team, so I don't know all the details, but I know that he's continuing to pursue other options, and there are other countries that would come forward and offer political asylum, and I could see that could happen at some point. And I know that he would like to come back to the U.S. if there was ever possible, but those are questions for his legal team.
Well, I very much appreciate you joining us here in the studio today, Laura Poitras.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Poitras, who's a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and artist who has made a trilogy of films about post-9/11 America. Her first film, My Country, My Country, focused on the Iraq War and was nominated for an Academy Award in 2007. The second, The Oath, about Guantanamo, was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards. And the third of the 9/11 trilogy, Citizen 4, is now out in theaters. And it's about the NSA mass surveillance and Edward Snowden. And her NSA reporting contributed to a Pulitzer Prize for public service awarded to The Guardian and The Washington Post. And along with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, she's the co-founder of The Intercept. And Laura will have her first solo museum exhibition at the Whitney Museum in 2016, and she currently lives in Berlin.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.